speaks a Semitic language, or that person is Irish, or that person is something else. So we divide people up, more or less neutrally, by languages. So we're dealing now with another of the Semitic people. You'll recall, perhaps, by mentioning, the Hittites were the first Indo-European speakers whom we encountered. We'll encounter many more of those as we go along. Now, back to our friends the Assyrians. They built this enormous imperial state largely on the basis of a very large army, the use of iron weapons, and the use of cavalry. Now, a large army is not so remarkable in and of itself. The use of iron weapons is important. Previously, we have been working through what we might call the Bronze Age, and the weapons were bronze. The Assyrians, with their iron weapons, simply had a higher grade of military technology than the peoples whom they encountered. Cavalry, for the Assyrians, was basically a tool of getting to the battlefield quickly. They didn't really understand the use of cavalry on the battlefield. The Persians, as we'll see in a few minutes, were the ones who discovered how to use cavalry on the battlefield. But the Assyrians were able to get there fast. And that was really what they learned from the use of horses. Now, in 722 BC, as we saw in our last lecture, they conquered the kingdom of Israel. And they deported its inhabitants, the 10 lost tribes, beginning the period of the exile. Now, the Assyrians were, as I hinted in the lecture on the Hebrews, bad guys. Their basic policies were cruel. Their basic policy was state terrorism. They routinely rounded up and killed large numbers of people just by way of sending a message to everybody else that they could do that to them too at any time and for no reason. Even their art glorified fear and destruction. If you've ever seen, for example, any of the great Assyrian stone carvings, there are some in museums in this country, in the Metropolitan in New York, but there are particularly large and fierce ones in the British Museum in London, if you've ever been in the room there of antiquities. To walk by one of these panels is actually to feel eerie, to feel scared. That's exactly what they meant to evoke in you. Fear. Terror. Well, not surprisingly, the Assyrians didn't evoke much loyalty. They didn't evoke much affection. And what they did evoke was a challenge. Now, this challenge arose from a coalition of peoples who very often were seen as liberators. You see? As liberators from the Assyrians. They didn't necessarily want to be conquered by these new guys, but they really wanted out from under the thumb of the Assyrians. Now, in this great coalition of people, one key group were the Neo-Babylonians. Now, you'll remember we talked of the old Babylonians. That's the people of Hammurabi, he of the great law code. The Neo-Babylonians are the people whose most famous king was Nebuchadnezzar, who turns up in some of the later books of the Hebrew Bible. He reigned from about 605 to about 562 B.C., Now, he built a very large realm based in Mesopotamia, based in the same areas where the Assyrians had been. Their capital now is at Babylon and not at Nineveh, but the point is that the center of this realm is basically in the same place that the center of the Assyrian realm had been based. Now, the main achievement of the Neo-Babylonians, whose high point lasted only about a century, they were not really on the scene very long, was the massive rebuilding of the city of Babylon, creating there the famous Hanging Gardens, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world, an elaborate palace complex with beautiful pleasure gardens surrounding it. So then the Neo-Babylonians were one of the peoples in the great coalition that brought down the Assyrians. There were also a number of minor players at this time. For example, up in central Anatolia, people called the Lydians. Now, the Lydians might very well have disappeared from history. They weren't particularly remarkable, were it not for two things. One, they invented coinage. As far as we can tell, they invented coinage. And eventually, of course, virtually everyone who came after them used coined money. Did they always borrow it from the Lydians? Well, it may very well be, as we'll see in a minute, that they borrowed it from the Persians, who borrowed it from the Lydians, who disseminated it a great deal further. But the point is, the Lydians invent coinage. The second thing is their legendary king, Croesus. Now, his wealth was legendary, probably because he heaped up coins, because he collected a large number of these coins as taxes and tribute. His very name meant wealth in the ancient world. We still say somebody's rich as Croesus, or maybe some of us say things like that. So, Croesus is famous, and the Lydians made money, but they also walked their weary hour on the stage and departed, not really much to be heard from afterwards. Not so the other great party, the other great party to the anti-Assyrian coalition. These were the Medes and the Persians. Now, these were peoples who had been living, the Medes in the Zagros Mountains, the mountain range basically that divides Iran from Iraq. They'd been living in those mountains for a very long time, and we haven't heard much about them. And indeed, their people in antiquity hadn't heard much about them. The Persians, on the other hand, lived down on the Iranian plain. And they had been there for a very long time, but again, had not been particularly interested in the lands to their west, in Mesopotamia. Eventually, and we can say actually of the Medes and the Persians that they're ethnically related. They speak a similar language. They're roughly the same kinds of people, but there are some differences among them. In any case, they began to forge a great unity. And under the great King Cyrus, Cyrus was the Shah. He was the Shah in Shah, the king of kings, founded a monarchy.